two, three, four.
Y'all ready for this?
Ladies and gentlemen.
Never been done before.
We're talking about a subject.
To bring you to the light.
Farewell to you, people.
Hold up, hold up. This is DJ Kool Herc, the father of hip hop. This is going out to my man over in Japan. Yutaka. To my man, Crazy A. This how we do. For all the B-boys and B-girls. Get ready. Right about now, we're gonna rock with the rockets and jam with the jammers. Don't stop. Keep on.
DVD hanging out with you this afternoon. It is Hard Knock Radio.
Right now, sitting in front of us is the man who started it all. We have, you know, in different genres of music, we can go and talk to the Elvis Presleys. Well, we can't talk to the Elvis Presleys. They might want to talk to whoever started the blues. That person is gone. They might want to talk to the person who started reggae. That person is gone. But we are fortunate to have sitting in front of us the person who started this thing that we call hip-hop. The father of hip-hop, the one and only Mr. Cool, DJ Kool Herc. How you doing, sir?
Peace, man. I'm chilling, man.
You know, man, I remember you from way back in the 70s. I hate to go back that far. But the thing is, man, you still got the same build, man. What? How come you don't age, man? As the father of hip-hop, you supposed to be, you know, old and out of shape.
I said after pastor.
So how have you managed to just stay in shape like this all these years?
Well, you know, you just got to take it. I've been on a rocky road, you know what I'm saying? I was out in the struggle, and that got me on the right track. And that's what people out in the struggle, they know what I mean. You know what I'm saying? Overcome it. And don't be no hypocrite. And I've been on that. Rather been on that road, man.
Did you ever think in your wildest dreams that we would be at this point in time with hip-hop where it is now? I mean, it's a multi-billion dollar a year industry. It's something that even the presidents of the United States has to acknowledge. It's everywhere you go. I mean, did you ever think that what you helped start or what you started was going to be where it is today?
No. I'm doing it still for fun because the love of it. We started it, me and my partners, you know, and people that rallied around me. And we started, but we never named it. And we never look at it like that we want to make money out of it. We were just enjoying ourselves with it, and a lot of our friends was enjoying what we put out. And that's been the same feeling I have right now.
Still for the love of it. You know, one of the things I remember talking to you one time, and you were very explicit about saying, like, the records that you used to play were funk records. And maybe you can explain for everybody listening, you know, the connection between this thing that we call hip-hop and the important role that funk has played in the development and the furthering of hip-hop.
Hip-hop is a big family, like a gumbo pot. We never excluded nobody from getting in it, and we didn't know who the people that was behind it making it. We just picked up a black record. And music have no color. So we was worried about who was the color the band made the record. It sound good to me, it sound lovely to me. Let me apply it to my audience. And over the years, the audience been loving what I've been applying to them. So I could if it was something on a rock record and I feel it's funky enough, that's what mean funky. If I hear something from a rock record that I could put in my repertoire, my format, I put it in there. If it's a Chinese record, got some little something I like in it, I'll put it in. It's just like you making a recipe and you try out little things to make it taste good. I tried different music and my ears was trained from my father telling me that's a good bounce. you know, what good music sounds like, or whatever reggae music was, it was. He defined that for me, because I didn't grow up with reggae records in my house. I had other records from different parts of the world, especially from the United States. You know, so I was into Bing Crosby White Christmas before it became that world famous record. I know that record from back and forth, back in my hands on every word. You know, Ella Fitzgerald, Nat King Cole, that was his man. Nina Simone, you know, and Louis Armstrong. You know, you name it, man. We had it around in the house. Even Jim Reeves.
Man, you naming off all kind of crazy names, man. You're going back there.
Jim Reeves. Okay, so I'll know it. So a lot of white people see me singing songs and saying, how you know word for word? Because when I first got to the United States, that's what I was listening to, Cousin Boosie and Wolfman Jack. It wasn't no BLS. I didn't know about no WRL. So I was into the Three Dog Night and Judy in the Sky, you know, and then What You Are. And that record come from New Orleans where jazz come from. Now I found that track be used over and over. Even to this day, somebody was stumbling and come up with one of them strange phenomenal record called the Okie Pokie, and you find out that da-da-da-da-da-da is a New Orleans type of thing, you know what I'm saying? But I was, and just seeing people having fun, man. Got into the Bronx, went to a club. First of all, it was a place called St. Joseph on Bathgate Avenue. I live like four blocks away, 178 on Bathgate. And it was a school, it was a church party. And then you have places like Murphy Projects over by the Cross Bronx Expressway. They give parties there once every Friday. I mean, first Fridays. And I'm start getting, I say, more Americanized, more hip, and seeing how people react and dancing, you know. And little you know it, I'm picking up the gripes from the audience. I'm out there putting it, and hear people, how come you don't have that record? Well, why are you taking it over right there before the other part come on? And I'm one of them. So I took that concept from the dancer's perspective behind the turntable. So I'm not behind the turntable trying to make it beat sound like the other beat or Kim. No, I'm playing what we want to hear on the dance floor. And how whatever it come in, I can bring it to my best of my ability. So I'm not no DJ. I became a DJ by doing what I was doing. I was the host of the party and the dancer that's behind the turntable playing for my dancing friend out there.
You know, one of the interesting things, and maybe you could clarify this, we're talking with the father of hip-hop, the legendary Cool DJ Herc, or DJ Cool Herc in the house. There's the rumor that hip-hop started in the South Bronx. But you're not from the South Bronx, so where did it start from? And you know, talk about the importance of 1520, Cedric and Cedar.
Okay, South Bronx is a place, it's beautiful, people live there, but the stigma attached to South Bronx, you think South Bronx is just whitewashed with hoes, pimps, hookers, and all that. Anybody mentioned two things out of Hunts Point that might come to people's mind, and in the United States or wherever you hear the word Hunts Point, is a produce market, yep, on your hair, hookers. Right. But Hunts Point people live there, and I'm pretty sure they don't like it, and I'm not going to trample on them. You know what I'm saying? It only sounded more, I say, dramatic, saying South Bronx, out of all of this, this thing called hip-hop came from. But no else with the hookers and the, no. South Bronx have nothing to do with hip-hop. It was in the Bronx, and hip-hop started in the Bronx, period. But specifically, hands down, is 1520 Cedric Avenue. That's where I live at.
And Cedric Avenue, that's in what we would call, the West Bronx.
I'm going to let you know exactly Major Deegan Highway. It's not in the South Bronx. 180th Street Bridge is not in the South Bronx. Yankee Stadium is not in the South Bronx. And Cedric Avenue is the service road for the Major Deegan Highway, leads straight to Yankee Stadium.
Well, see, I'm from Soundview. So when you where you guys were at, I would call it the Central Bronx, because the West Bronx would have been Riverdale and Kennedy and Marble Hill and all those areas. So you was like, to me, where I was sitting, you was in the middle of the Bronx, but you call it the West Bronx.
Well, really, some people might say the Grand Concourse separate East and the West. You go a little further, might say, okay, Jerome Avenue, demographically, with this, no, you're on the West Side. You can't pass Jerome Avenue saying you're on the east. Yeah. You know? So between Jerome Avenue is like 5 or 6 blocks apart before you really can say, I'm on the west side. Yeah.
The other interesting thing, and I remember when we was talking to you a long time ago, was the fact that you were one of the few people that could throw parties and keep the peace. Because if you remember back in those days, you know, you couldn't go from one neighborhood to the next. You couldn't come from my neighborhood and maybe even go to Bronx River. If you was in Soundview without permission, you couldn't definitely come from your part of town to any parts of us without having any drama. So how were you able to do these early parties back in the early 70s at the height of all this gang stuff and keep the peace?
Because me and my friends, we wasn't suckers. We was men, we was friends, and we just had a little camaraderie amongst ourselves. And a lot of the gang bangers that wanted to become gang bangers, we knew them. They knew us. So we didn't have to, I say, prop up ourselves by putting any gang colors on our backs.
Your size didn't have anything to do with it?
No, didn't have nothing to do with it. I didn't never use brawn to get my point across, you know, or intimidation or like that. So what happened was a lot of those gang members asked us, five of us individually, to become division leaders, to be more stronger. And we just said, no, we wasn't with it.
Who were those five friends? Who were these early friends that you used to hang with?
There's Mark Walters. He got Coke. He got Ronald Haley and myself and a few other guys. But that was the main crooks of the West Side when you mentioned who's over there, you know? There's a few other people there, but that immediate, that was that right there. Coke, Ronald, and Mark.
It is Hard Knock Radio, Davey D hanging out with you. Listening to an excerpt from an interview that we did with Kool Herc as we're celebrating 50 years of hip hop. Central to the landmark party that Kool Herc gave August 11th, 1973, 50 years ago, was his sister, Cindy Campbell. And we had the opportunity to have her speak several times with us, but one of the more recent times was to our class over at SF State. And so we're going to share part of that conversation with you as she's talking about the role of women in hip hop, her role, and what that first party was like. What do you remember? What's your earliest thoughts on women that you saw? And even describing your own role, let's start with that. Let's talk about that first party, August 11th, 1973. How did that come about? What was the role that you and your brother played in doing that?
Well, I must say that the first role model that I have for me as a woman is my mother. And it should be, for most people, it should be your first role model. And my mother certainly was. She was very supportive in what my brother and I, we were doing. When I told her that I wanted to, you know, give a back-to-school party to get clothing, I wanted to take a lot of the financial burden of my mother. It was 6 of us that they had to clothe to go back to school, and my father was the type of person, when we went shopping, he goes straight to whatever is on sale, and he didn't have the patience. You know, if you didn't like it, he was going to buy it. So my thing was, I wanted to be able to buy my own clothes, and I saw that the recreation room was there, and used it as an advantage to rent the room to give a back-to-school party for my friends, and at the same time, to get some money go back to school shopping.
That first party, you know, it was to get clothing and all that. What do you remember about that? What was the vibe like? Who was there? How was it set up? What was the music that you all were playing?
Oh, it was amazing, because you have to remember, we're young kids, we're teenagers, so the whole idea also was to come to the party to be comfortable in your sneakers, in your jeans, your T-shirt, or your Wrangler, your Lee jacket. And we just wanted people to be comfortable in that sense. We went out and we bought records to make sure that you could be comfortable in the records you wanted to hear. At the time, you need to have the slow jams, so you want to have the slow song so you could dance with, you know, guy or girl you were interested in. The whole idea to building up to the day of the party, was exciting. We got refreshments there also. We made sure the place was cleaned up, the buzz was out, who was going to be there, and, you know, what kind of dance you're going to do. The B-boys were putting their skills together so they could, you know, dance to the music that Herc was going to be playing on the turntable. So that whole thing was so exciting. You really have to be there, and I can speak with it with a lot of passion, so people get the feeling of what it was like. But it was absolutely it was fun, and it was innocent fun because nobody got hurt, and everybody enjoyed themselves. When our parents were there, it was being supervised. The party went on until, like Herc would say, the break of dawn, so 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning. But people felt they knew their kids were someplace safe.
Do you know, it's interesting, the parents were there, because oftentimes we see hip-hop as something that was just devoid of that. But your parents were involved with the whole sound system and all that. Can you speak on that and that influence? You already said your mother was a role model.
My mom, she was inside. She saw the refreshments and the hot dogs. Not only my parents, but you had the people that were from the Tenants Association in the building. They were there in the lobbies, and they were outside, and if people wanted to do anything, you know, like smoke or whatever, they knew they had to leave the vicinity and go down the street when they wouldn't be seen, so they could do that. And we also had the police precinct was down the block from us. So when you think of hip-hop going back then, it was built on a very positive, firm foundation. That's why hip-hop is strong, my belief is strong in the way it is right now, because it was built on such a firm, loving foundation. It wasn't built on gang money, illegal money, drug money, anything like that. It was just clean money that I worked from the Neighborhood Youth Corps, put together, rented the room for $25. The admission to get in was 25 cents for the girls and 50 cents for the fellas. Your refreshments was cheap. We also sold English 800 and Colt 45. So it was, you know, you can't do that today now with the parents around, but it was supervised, and it was great. It was fun. So whenever you see a hip-hop gathering, even now today, and you have the pioneers of there, you notice that it's a whole different influence. You know, you have the grandparents are there, the parents, the kids are there, and I always say, what other generation you have where your kids want to come and hang out with you because of the people that you know. Right, baby?
Right. Well, you know, it's interesting. It's interesting because one of the things that come out is that people often say you're the first lady of hip-hop, but many people have said the first family. And I wanted to, you know, and I think you've been speaking to the importance of that, that this is a family thing, you and your brother working together, and that sort of unified force has been terrific. One of the things that we don't want to reduce you to is just somebody who threw this one party, but as I joked about in the beginning, when anybody needed to talk to your brother, they had to talk to you. And this was early on. So in many ways, that entrepreneurial and you managing him is something that was a first as well, and maybe you could speak to that, because that's been underplayed.
Exactly. I mean, when you look at it, I was the first hip-hop promoter who promoted that party. Herc was basically the first hip-hop artist, you know, and Coco Rock was there. We had the B-boys there. It was very, very much organized. We never gave a party just to be given it. We gave it when the people said, when is the next party? When the recreation room became too small, we had to look for a larger venue. So we were pretty much there looking out for, you know, the people that came to the party.
Who were the first people that were there? Name off some of the people that were DJing and MCing and what have you that you remember.
You have Coke LaRock, first hip hop MC. You have Timmy Tim. You had Mike with the lights and the Aretha Wadi. We gave him the name Mike with the lights. At the time, we didn't have a strobe light. So his job was to stand by the light switch. And when Herc would say, Mike, hit the lights, he stood there and he blinked the lights back and forth and back and forth because he couldn't afford a strobe light.
So you did the ghetto strobe light, the homemade strobe light.
But one of the things we did when you part of, you know, the hip hop, when you come into the hip hop circle, because hip hop pretty much, you know, you have started with graffiti. So you have to have a tag name. Everybody has a tag name, so you have to give yourself a name. And Hurt pretty much gave people their name also. So early B-Boys we had the Nigga Twins, Kevin and Keith. We had the original B-Boy Wallace D. We had Trixie. We had Sasha, El Dorado Mike. KRS-One, he didn't come to the parties at the time, but we found out later he lived in the building next door to us. Above us on the third floor, Swiss Beats' father and family lived above us. So it was a lot of history, and a lot of people came from out of the neighborhood, and just about everybody we know, and we're all family.
The 1520 Cedric Avenue is where that first party took place, and a few years ago there was a fight to try and save that building and try and get it considered a historic landmark, as developers wanted to just develop it into something else. What's the status of that now?
I have to say that we were able to fight the big landlord who wanted to do that. We were able to get a new landlord who purchased the building working with the city of New York. And it's still there. It's affordable housing the way it was when we moved in. Let's see, we have to thank Senator Chuck Schumer for standing behind us and getting it done.
Wait, so Senator Chuck Schumer got behind making that a historic landmark?
He did. And also Serrano, Congressman Serrano, he was the one who... You know, I had the papers, you know, signed and pushed for it. So we had people behind us from the city of New York helping us.
Right. One of the things we should point out, you know, what made this party a little different than others is that Herc was very popular at the time. And so him doing a party was a big deal. You know, like you have the neighborhood celebrity, the guy who's the athlete doing a party, that's a big deal. But also what makes Herc stand out for years, and nobody could really get with him from Afrika Bambaataa on down, was the sound system. Can you talk about the Herculoid sound system or the Herculoid sound system and what that meant and where you all even got the idea to have this massive thing that nobody had ever seen before when you all did a party? That's why people went to Cool Herc parties. It was like, you have this little system here, and then you got something that's like, whoa, this is bigger than life.
Right, you had the column system. You probably seen it on YouTube where Herc is driving around with these two huge column speakers in his convertible. I mean, that's like the ultimate beatbox right there. Boombox, I would say. That's all I did. Well, these speakers were tall. This is tall as you were, you know, and the music was just coming out of it. And Herc would play the records that most people didn't have the records to practice and dance, to do their breakdancing. So they look forward to coming there. And one of the things that we did also, we gave a dance contest. So you would win $25 to split between you and your partner. And this was money that we collected from the door. So we were always giving back. You know, people would say, how do you feel about it? About making all these millions and all this money. But, you know, that's really not what it's about. Also, it's about giving back and the love and the appreciation that people are, you know, enjoying it.
Listening to an excerpt from an interview with Cindy Campbell, the sister of Cool Herc, as we are celebrating 50 years of hip hop. Want to change pace and talk and let you hear a bit of an interview that we did with DJ Hollywood and Curtis Blow, talking about those early days. So we're going to jump into listening to what many people consider hip-hop's first rapper, DJ Hollywood.
I tell you what, before we talk to you, why don't we take a listen to one of your trademark songs?
Rappers, hang on to your head. It's Hollywood, now back from the dead. To all you rappers who claim to be king, you know, this is really my thing.
legendary DJ Hollywood, who is often considered hip-hop's first rapper. You know, you always had an interesting position in hip-hop, because I'm more associated Hollywood with the clubs and the type of vibe that was coming out of that angle, as opposed to being a part of hip-hop. I mean, we always thought Hollywood was disco. Is that an accurate perception? And how did you see the early days of hip-hop?
Okay, in the beginning, let's take it way back. Let's go 68, 69. In 68, 69, that's when America, urban America, cared a lot about their kids. They had venues for you to explore with your talent. There was talent show competition everywhere. YMCA, Boys Club, after school centers, every place you could go, there was a talent show. So I began in talent shows singing in a group.
Right.
Five guys. And we were like the Temptations. We had the white gloves, the steps, the moves, everything. And it was about making it to rehearsals. Getting to rehearsals, guys couldn't, you know, always had excuses for not coming to rehearsal. So I had to think of something I could do by myself. And I had a microphone and a guitar amp, you know, that I always practiced my singing with at home.
Right.
And one day I'm sitting there practicing and the radio was playing. This is before FM, okay?
Man, you're going way back now.
Yeah. This is before FM. And I'm listening to WWRL. And on WWRL, they had Frankie Crocker.
Okay. Legendary DJ Frankie Crocker.
DJ Frankie Crocker. And I'm listening to him. And he's reciting poetry smoothly, but it's not on time, you know.
Okay.
Track. And I'm a singer, so I'm listening to him, and I say, man, I can do that. But I can sing it. You understand what I'm saying?
Right.
So then I started to put my little poems together, and I'm singing them to the tracks, you know, that I'm playing in the house. So now I go to an after-hour spot, and they got a DJ there, and he's got two turntables, but he's only using one of them.
Right.
And he's playing, you know, and then he'll take the record off and change it. So one day he says, man, I gotta run. I gotta make a run. Look, Hollywood, just hold this down for me. Just, you know, change the record. So now I'm using the one turntable, and in between each record, I'm taking the needle off, and while I'm changing the record, I'm talking to the people. You understand?
Right,
He just took the record off and put the next record on. I'm talking to the people. Hey, what's up? How you doing? Bop, 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 bop. And I said, hey, anybody came out tonight to have some fun? You know, and people started answering me.
Wow, okay.
So therefore, I started formulating things I could do to make people respond to me while I'm changing the record.
Right.
Then I tried doing it with the two turntables. See, at the time, I never knew that you had a headphone.
Right.
Your records up. I never knew nothing about that.
Because
I had a mic mixer that was a four, it take four mics in it, and, you know, it's no headphone, and it's just a mic mixer. So you just turn the knob up when you want the sound to come up.
Right.
So I'm talking in between that, and then I say, man, listen, instead of going from that turntable and taking the record off and putting another record on, I could put the other record on this turntable.
Right.
So then I started to do that. And about 1970, I met a guy named Bojangles. There was a place called Charles Gallery on 125th Street.
You talking about the dancer Bojangles?
No, not the dancer Bojangles.
Oh, okay.
Bojangles was the brother of the guy that owned Charles Gallery.
Okay.
Charles Huggins, which is Melvin Moore's husband, was his brother.
Okay.
Okay. And he took me in the disco. I'm 13, 14 years old. And he took me in the disco. I don't belong in there, but he took a liking to me, you know, because I used to come by and, you know, help him clean up and whatever, you know. And on Sundays was his night to play. You know, during the week, they had the big guys playing in there because it was for the elite crowd.
Right.
So, I'm listening to music on all sides. All the beats and stuff, I was into the beats, but I was into the whole record as well. And I learned to put my conversation, you know, my little raps that I invented, wherever the break was in the record, I could time myself to lay a rap down long enough for that break to come and then get out of the record in time for the music to come back in.
Uh-huh.
You understand what I'm saying?
So you was adding yourself to the music.
Right. I'm adding myself as another artist to the record.
Did you do your trademark sing, song, and type of rap at that time?
Right. This is how it all got started. This is how the conversation end of hip-hop began.
Okay, are you able to give an example?
Okay, well, like, let's say, like Scorpio was playing.
Okay.
Okay, now it goes, bam, 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 bam. All right, now right there is where I would start to kick my spiel.
Okay.
Okay, when it breaks down. I'm waiting, you know, because, see, I'm playing the music and I'm doing the talking at the same time, so I had to choose spots where the record would make its break so that I could use my conversation piece right there. You understand
right.
what I'm saying?
Okay.
So, therefore, I didn't need a guy to spin for me.
Okay.
I could spin the record, and I would pick and choose a time where the record's going to break that I could kick a little conversation, get a little crowd feedback, and then move on to the next record.
Give me an example of some of the early stuff.
Well, like a while ago when I want you to know just who you've been listening to. Listen to me now while I tell you how, who I am and what I do. 5'9 and a half, bow-legged as you ever wanted to see. Just look over by the music, baby doll, cause I'm talking about little old me. It's Holly girl and I'm so glad that you came on down so we could spend some time together and maybe even mess around. Said you look so good, you look so fine, you make me shake and shiver. But in the end, when it all goes down, you know the Hollywood will deliver.
You know, now that style, you know, I equate, you know, I see Curtis Blow has that type of, I call it like a radio type of style, right. You know, like it's almost like you're a DJ on the radio. To me, I separated that type of flavor from the type of flavor that, like when I was younger, I would kick on the streets or others because it was a little bit more, it wasn't as polished. Was that intentional because of that radio influence or was, you know, I didn't really see as many people or hear as many people come with that smooth type of style, or, you know, on a street tip.
Well, that's because they weren't interjecting entertainment into the music.
Uh-huh.
They were just interjecting their power of vocals to the music. I was trying to entertain. I was trying to be what I never saw nobody else be. You understand what I'm saying? I'm a singer, but as a singer, I wasn't making it.
Right.
Now I'm singing, and I'm singing my song.
Right.
As opposed to singing, because when we were at talent shows, we practiced everybody else's routine.
Okay.
You know, we practice the Moments, and we practice Blue Magic, and we practice the Temptations. Now I'm practicing Hollywood.
And here we are today, you know?
Right. Yeah, they are. And just to catch a rebound on how it goes down, through all my trials and tribulations, when I started, it had no name. It had no title. It belonged to no one. It was just, let's go ahead and see who can work. Because it was battles everywhere, people throwing down. And I just came to do what it was I could do.
Now, this comes to the other question. The term hip-hop, that's a big debated thing as to where it came up. Now, Malcolm X used the term hip-hop to describe going to the hop, which was short for dance, and it was where the hipsters went. And there's a quote with him saying, I'm hip-hopping around the town. I also heard hip-hop pioneer Lovebug Starsky coined the phrase. But there's also...
Lovebug Starsky coined the phrase of putting the hip-hops together. The hip-hop, the hip-hip, the hop, the hop, the hop, dip-a-dip-a-dip-dip-dip-dip. But that's not hip-hop. Hip-hop was born in the parks with the kids of all phases. You know, like the way they got hip-hop now is people think hip-hop is this or hip-hop is that. Hip-hop is an element of a whole lot of stuff.
Right.
You You know, it's a dress, it's a movement, it's a language, it's a feeling, and you had to be there to have it. You understand what I'm saying? It wasn't something that somebody brought to you. You had to be there to have it back in the days.
Right.
Now, everybody's hip-hop because that's the way it is, because it's the most popular thing to do.
Peace. This is Brother Africa Bambaataa, godfather of hip-hop culture. And I'm on Hard Knock Radio as they blow your funky mind, sucker.
What's up? This is Hwapalette, and you're listening to Hard Knock Radio, news, views, and hip-hop.
This is SJ Miyoshiro, old school graffiti writer. And when I'm not, I'm listening to Hard Knock Radio.
Yeah. Peace and respect, family. My name is Jahi, and I'm the founder of the Bay Area Hip-Hop Archives. And my company, Microphone Mechanics, has partnered with OMCA, the Oakland Museum of California, for the 50th anniversary of hip-hop culture on August 11th at 7 p.m. We are doing the Bay Area Hip-Hop Archives induction, celebrating over 55 Bay Area hip-hop artists, activists, and educators. That's right, y'all, a celebration. The 50th anniversary, live at OMCA, 1000 Oak Street, Oakland, California. Hope to see you there.
Peace. It's funny how money changes situations. Miscommunication lead to complications. My emancipation don't fit your equation.
Welcome to Opinion Poor People's Revolutionary Radio. This is your co-host Amir Cornish, Decolonized Academy graduate and Poor Magazine Youth Poly Scholar reporter with Poly Scholar and poet Mudia Silencio and Poor Poet and Poly Scholar Tiny.
Right here in occupied Deep East Uchin, or as the settlers call it, Oakland. Listen in, learn up, love up. Us poverty scholars are always about us.
Poverty and homelessness kill. On today's broadcast of Poor People's Radio, we honor the life of a poverty scholar who transitioned to the spirit journey way too soon because of violence, of waiting for housing, while sleeping on the streets. And then we will speak with legal warrior from Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights and the struggle of poverty tolls. In other words, towing our homes when we are sleeping in our cars. And finally, research released by Poor Magazine Low Income and No Income formerly houseless youth on the terrifying connection between the end of eviction moratorium and the increase in the homelessness.
The odds have always been stacked against me when back's against the wall. I feel right at home, y'all, sitting right at home all. But so is telling young men that selling is a sin if you don't offer new ways to win.
We are blessed to actually be here today bringing in some powerful fellow poverty scholars from occupied Miwok territory, a.k.a. Marin County, which is really one of the most vicious spaces for houseless folks to be, and specifically one of the examples all across occupied Turtle Island of so much wealth hoarding and land occupying. We are blessed to have our warrior relative, Robbie Paulson.
I want to speak in honor and remembrance of Jimmy Sanders, who was an elder, black elder, living outside Santa Fe, who had his Section 8 voucher taken away from him without any due process, thrown out on the street, all of his possessions taken. And for months, he spent under a tent underneath the freeway under the promise of housing. And while he was underneath that freeway, that dirty freeway, breathing in gasoline, brake dust, he caught COVID, got pneumonia, went to the hospital, and his health rapidly deteriorated. And just a few days ago, he passed away. And it is a direct result of the dangers that he was forced into by the city of Santa Fe, who promised him housing, forced him into a dangerous situation under a freeway for months. And now he's gone. And all the promises that they made are empty. And all the harm they did is real. And we all got to deal with the consequences of this system that's killing our people.
Thank you, Robbie, out there in occupied Miwok territory. Thank you, Jimmy, for living on Mama Earth humbly, for having hope always, even in the face of so much perpetration and hate. We know that so many of our relatives die this way. We go through these different little murders of the soul, and we know we do not have the energy to constantly fight, because fighting for every little thing, every crumb, is just sometimes too much. There are too many of our relatives that we lose through this violence of capitalism and violent gentrification and violent wealth hoarding, which goes on in a city like San Rafael, where they have so many resources, that that could happen. But it happens all the time. Robbie, can you tell us, because you said he lost his Section 8 certificate. Did they have him back on a wait list or some mess like that?
They said they were going to put him on a list, and then it expired. He got in a car wreck like 10 years ago. His back would lock up. He could hardly walk from injuries from his spine being fractured. This was an elder that needed our help. He needed housing, and he got ignored. And he endured horrible conditions at the San Rafael Service Support Center for months, trying to get into housing because they promised him housing. And he was one of the few who got passed over. That's the kind of disparities we're seeing, especially for our Black elders and other people that are discriminated against in Marin County. It results in people dying. And that's what people just forget. You know, this is real life, real consequences that you don't get to turn back. You know, Jimmy's gone. And he was a sweet person. He was a generous person. He was a wise person. Jimmy was a generous, beautiful spirit. And now he's gone on. And that's a tragedy. It didn't have to happen.
You brought up some issues that I think we need to name. When you're already dealing with illness, when you're dealing with medical fragility, when you're dealing with disability, and you have to suffer what I call the violence of exposure, which means that we are in a position where we don't have a heater, we don't have a warm blanket, we don't have a place that we can shelter in. When they tell you to shelter in place, how are you going to do that if you don't got a place? When oftentimes we're worried just about keeping our clothes not wet. You can't heal when you have no home, when you have nowhere to go. He was under a freeway overpass, which meant that he was getting fumes and essentially poisoned every day. Well, for any of us who know about COVID, and I've suffered it now 3 times, it specifically attacks the lungs and the immune system. So he was absolutely killed by homelessness, but more importantly, by the systems that make sure that we don't matter. I just want to say, Robbie, I appreciate you so much. I know that you're on the street with our relatives all the time as a fellow poverty scholar yourself. People should check out his work on poormagazine.org and also in this month's street sheet. We'll talk to you real soon.
Up next, legal warrior from Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights.
We know that there's multiple ways, once we're outside, that we end up staying outside, that we can't ever seem to get ahead, even if we try. When me and Ma were on the street for years, we would get a hoopty sometimes and sleep in the back of it and, you know, be happy that we had somewhere. And then the hoopty would be towed. They call those poverty tows. It's an interesting term because, of course, we're folks in poverty. And in a lot of ways, those are our homes. So I can consider it towing our home. So we are blessed to have one of the warriors in this fight, standing with a lot of us poor folks on the front line, the acting legal director for Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights, Zashra. Welcome to Poor People's Radio.
Thank you for having me.
What is the fight that's been going on to resist the poverty tows, towing our homes, our cars when we're sleeping in them and we're on the street?
The Stop Poverty Tows Coalition in San Francisco is a group of community organizations that's been working on this issue for years, basically explaining to folks that if you already can't afford to pay your tickets, it makes no sense for the city to tow your vehicle. Usually the only way folks can access transportation, go to work, support their families, or for many folks, they're actually sheltering in their vehicles. It makes no sense to take that away from folks who already can't afford to pay as a punishment that does nothing for the government. They lose money by selling people's vehicles at these junk auctions. They force people to rack up hundreds of dollars in towing fees, daily garage fees that you're expected to pay before you get your vehicle back, resulting in effectively everyone losing their vehicles permanently just because of this tow, just because they couldn't afford to pay, thrusting people into more homelessness, more poverty. And really, it's part of San Francisco and California's war on low-income folks. And so that's been the fight. That's been the struggle over the last couple of years. And that's what the Court of Appeal in California has now said is an unconstitutional practice. So San Francisco is not allowed to, without a judge, without any approval from any sort of court officer, go and seize someone's vehicles just because they have late parking tickets.
I know that Lawyers Committee was involved in that fight. I'm just curious, because that's been going on for a while. How do you feel you got to this place where you've gotten some success?
The amount of community advocacy on this issue, the amount of data gathering, the amount of personal stories that people told about their experiences, why these tolls were so harmful for them, collecting massive amounts of data on how the city is actually losing money on these practices, how if you don't have any money to give the government because you can't afford to pay your tickets, it makes no sense for the government to spend hundreds and hundreds of dollars to tow you to sell your vehicle when they're not going to get any money back out of it. And when you sort of look at the fact that most folks, I mean, 20% of folks in the Bay Area can't afford a $400 emergency, that's two parking tickets, right? So it's no surprise that folks can't afford to pay. SFMTA board members responded to a lot of our coalition's advocacy, suggesting that they also didn't know why these tows were happening. And yet you had the bureaucratic intransigence of not actually getting it done. Even at a time when, you know, the current city attorney in San Francisco actually supported a bill years ago to end these kinds of poverty tows. So a tremendous community effort went into this win. And then, of course, you know, now several years of litigation that led us to the Court of Appeal.
What's the procedure now that this new ruling passed?
Yeah, it's a really important point. So basically, folks who have their cars wrongfully taken, they're entitled to a tow hearing, and they can request one from the agency that's taken their vehicle, and they're supposed to be able to get that vehicle back. Now, we're going to see that playing out over the next couple months. But the reality is, if your vehicle was already held by the government for more than 30 days, they probably sold it at an auction. Those folks are going to be entitled to damages because the city deprived them of their vehicle. And the court has now said that that was in violation of the Fourth Amendment. So we can expect future challenges to actually get folks to recover what they lost from this unconstitutional practice. What we have right now from the court is just a declaration that that's no longer constitutional. They can't do that. And so, yes, folks are going to be able to seek redress individually to get their vehicles back or to get money if their vehicle's already been stolen. But we'll have to see how that pans out over the next few months.
Tell listeners how they can support y'all. Really beautiful work, and we appreciate you so much. How do they find out about your work?
Please check us out on our website, lccrsf.org. Would love to hear from you. Always welcome volunteers for the work, and thank you all so much for everything you do.
You are listening to Poor People's Radio. Up next, we will hear from youth poverty scholar researchers on the impact of the end of the eviction moratorium on all of us poor folks.
I want to give a shout out to the youth. Yeah. I just want to really appreciate you. This
is Poor Magazine Youth Media Research Project. All of us youth are who have struggled with housing insecurity or homelessness. We are all poverty scholars, and our research is rooted in our knowledge as well as folks who have been directly impacted by the end of the eviction moratorium across this state and now are houseless.
Investigations on the end of the eviction moratorium, homelessness and gentrification research is poor people lay research as defined by Poor Magazine.
Our reports will include the findings we discovered on wealth and land hoarders who have fueled the overdevelopment, blighting, and gentrification of our hoods and towns. We will also look at the connection between sweeps of houses people and our criminalization, the lies of so-called affordable housing. And we will present a proposal to continue the eviction moratorium indefinitely and listen / support and help us homeless people build our own solutions like Homefulness, a rent-free housing and healing model created by all of houses and poor youth, elders, mamas, and uncles. Well, I am a resident, and without which me and my mama would not have housing.
Lots of people become houseless in our own hoods because of eviction or increase in rent prices. Lots of landlords sell their property to bigger companies to make more profit in their hands. Lots of families that rent the property aren't notified that their landlords have just sold the property till the last minute. And that last minute becomes very stressful to families because they have nowhere to sleep and their house isn't theirs anymore. And are eventually kicked out of their homes, having nowhere to go but live on the street.
We also become homeless in our own hoods when we lose our support systems as families and friends have to move out of the Bay Area. Then something we never thought would happen does. Our rent-controlled housing is taken away from us. When your landlord decides to illegally raise your rent to market rate, we are forced out on the streets after being evicted and are unable to raise enough money to pay the exorbitant fees it costs to get a new home.
One way we become houseless is rich people buy apartments in our neighborhood and flip them and start to evict people to get more rent.
An eviction moratorium is a stop on all evictions, whether the rent is being paid by the tenant or not, which are put in place to stop people from becoming homeless in a thing like a global pandemic where people can't pay the rent or a mass surge in the price of market rate housing.
The eviction moratorium was intended to prevent landlords from evicting their tenants for a specified period. However, rent payments may continue to pile up for tenants. Alameda County is going to deal with rent prices towards rent, and this impacts residents because the increase in rent price money will lead us to have to live in the streets.
How many people are already homeless in Oakland, California? Homelessness in the city has increased by 131% since 2015, and from 2019 to 2022, the number of unhoused people grew by 22%.
There are at least 10,000 houseless relatives in Oakland based on projects from 2022 and so many more.
Poor Magazine researchers are 36 recently evicted tenants from Alameda County. 92% of the ruthless radio reporters cited evictions as one of the main causes of our homelessness.
In addition, cities like Oakland and San Francisco should...
It's funny how money changes situation. Miscommunication leads to complication.
So that's all for this segment of Poor News Network. If you want to hear any of our Poor People's Revolutionary Radio, you can subscribe to Poor Magazine SoundCloud channel or find and subscribe to Poor News Network on YouTube. Thanks to Anita Johnson, David D, and Anthony Fest for the media access, and all of you for listening. All power to the people.
Now, how come your talk turned cold? Gain the whole world for the price of your soul. Trying to grab hold of what you can't control. Now you all lost for the sight to behold. Wisdom is better than silver and gold. I was hopeless, now I'm on hope roll. Every man wanna act like he's exempt. Need to get down on his knees and repent. Can't slick talk on the day of judgment. The movement's
ha, hey, ho, 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 Hard Knock Radio. East, west, hard north, south, radio, conectados. Man. Every set, every hood.
Knock, living for this hip hop. Listening to Hard Knock, ripping to the hard side. Learning from the Hard Knocks, living in these Hard Knocks. Listening to Hard Knock, questioning the park. Learning through these Hard Knocks, living for this hip hop. Listening to Hard Knock, ripping to the hard side.